Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
That is Carol of the Bells by Singing Bell. And as tonight is our Christmas show, it is now December 21st. Of course, this is now Thursday, and you're on LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christina, your host, and we're in studio tonight with my temporarily permanent replacement co-host, Richard Polinelli. Say hello to the folks, Richard.
Hello, folks, and I'm the not Bobby Jean Bell.
No, so you're
that's
not.
My official title.
And alas, Bobby Jean will be back with us after the first of the year, but she'll be a strictly a call-in from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And other than that, what's going on? You're leaving. You're going, where are you going tomorrow?
I'm going north. I'm going to go see the kids and the grandkids in San Francisco this weekend.
That's right. That's right. You're going to be up there with the crazy people.
Yeah. Just hopefully I can get in and get out and do so in one piece. That's really all I plan on when I go to that city.
Well, you know, they have a special place in Alcatraz just for you.
I have actually been there a couple of times, sadly.
Me too. I love that joint. It's really great.
Yeah, but I was on the other side of the bars with the door closed, so, you know, I think they were joking, but I wasn't sure there for a minute.
Yeah, it's just like you stand there at the bottom and yell, Capone, where were you?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to let Richard do our first ad tonight. Take it.
Okay, so you have written your first manuscript. Now what? If you're a first-time author, putting your story down on paper is just the beginning for you. Getting your words into the hands of readers and putting money into your bank account is the ultimate goal. But in today's publishing world, it's become harder and harder for first-time authors to land that publishing contract and get their books on the shelves. So, Tuscany Bay Books, a division of Black Dog Publishing based in Ventura County here in Southern California, has a better idea. We've launched a new program to help new authors put their words to page, their book on a shelf, and make their dreams come true. And at a royalty rate of 60% to the author. That's four times what you get from the traditional folks. So it's a little bit more money in your account.
Correct.
So if you are interested in a little bit more about what our program offers, you can give us a call today. It's 805-795-3165. Or you can email Jim Christina at jchristina@tuscanybaybooks.com. Or you can give me an email. I will answer. I often do. At rpolinelli@tuscanybaybooks.com. So, again, if you are looking to get your book out and you don't know quite how to go about doing that, we're here for you. So give us a call.
And you've got some specials running this week.
I've got, you know what? I'm playing Jolly Saint Rick this Christmas, okay? Starting on December 23rd, which is Saturday, while I am driving up north, or actually driving back from up north, five of my ebooks on Amazon, and it's got to be purchased through Amazon. It has to be the ebooks only.
Right.
Escaping Infinity, Maelstrom, From the Fields, Perfection's Arbiter, and the Del Rio series, the complete trilogy book. Every book of those five that is sold during that time period from the 23rd through the 27th, we're going to be donating at least 10% of those sales to the Children of Fallen Soldiers Relief Fund. Try to say that fast three times.
I don't have to.
No. So if you are looking to get yourself a gift or give somebody else a gift who likes to read, you can do so, and you can also give a much-needed gift to some kids who could use it. So it's going to be from the 23rd through the 27th, and hopefully we do this, and it's going to be something I want to do every year. Also on the 23rd through the 26th, we have a free book also on Amazon that we're giving away. It's called The Zombie Christmas Carol. It is satire and it is parody. It is not your Dickens from your grandfather's time. It's a little different. But that's going to be free for 3 days. You can download it on Amazon. And the last one, if you go to my website, scifiscribe.com, and sign up for my email list, you will get a free science fiction short story that I wrote called The Invited.
Cool.
I'm giving stuff away. So
apparently.
It's here. Come get it.
And you just had an anthology, your Sherlock Holmes anthology.
Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. About a week ago, a two-volume anthology called Sherlock Holmes Adventures in the Realm of H.G. Wells was released. I am one of, I think, 24 stories in the two-book set. Mm-hmm. I'm in volume two, and mine is The Misplaced Mystery Writer.
Ah.
And you get Sherlock Holmes, you get H.G. Wells, you get Edgar Allan Poe.
Wow. Well,
so there you go.
Well, thank you.
Like I said, I'm just giving away stuff right now.
The Writer's Block is also brought to you by Out West, which is our online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and Western lifestyles. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. National brands include Scully Leather Company, Rockmount Ranchwear, Dan Post Boots, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. And Scully Leather also is Wallmaker, so the cowboys that love the Wallmaker stuff, that comes from Scully Leather. You can shop online at www.scvoutwest.com. If you enter code number WB100, you'll get $10 off your first order. And apparently there's been a bunch of people do that. And their toll-free number is 877-340-9378. Give those folks a call. They're really nice. And they will be now answering the phone in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And last but not least, Target Freight has had a full truckload service since 2009, TFM Truckload. That's the best in the industry. Not only are they exceptionally good at what they do, but they strive to make your full truckload shipping experience unparalleled. Call TFM Truckload today. 844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski or any of the fine Target TFM staff. Tell them you heard it here in the Writer's Block, and TFM will have a little something extra for you. And if you're an LTL shipper, getting your freight moved your way, the most expedient way possible is what you need. One-stop shop, no hassle. Call Target Freight Management today. Their customized traffic movement program is the finest in the industry, bar none. So call them at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com. On the web for both truckload and LTL. Call today. No fooling. You won't be sorry you did. There you have it.
There you go.
And I'd like to also make the announcement that if you're listening and you want to call and talk to our author this evening, which will be on the air just a few minutes with us, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that is 818-602-4929. Okay. Sitting in our studio tonight, we have a gentleman that we've actually been chatting with him for quite a while back in the green room. He's fascinating. This guy's like really cool. His name is Jack Adler, and he's an ex-newspaperman, but an author extraordinaire. He's had several fiction and nonfiction books published. He has an author page on Amazon, and he's received a grant as a playwright from the Yaddo Foundation with several one-act plays produced and one published. He's a former columnist on a freelance basis for the Los Angeles Times travel section, and also he's written a column for Westways magazine. His wife, Barbara, and he have two sons. So if you would please, welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Jack Adler.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we just like to give you the clap, Jack.
As long as I didn't miss my cue.
There you go. We're fascinated just speaking we did with you in the green room for the short period that we did. And the book that we're going to be talking about primarily this evening is, now I have to go through and find my notes again. I just lose these things so fast. It's called A Colleague in the Shadows. Mm-hmm. It's a book about intrigue and all kinds of stuff during the First World War. And it's a historical novel, and it takes place all over Europe. Am I correct? Right, all over Europe,
mostly Paris and London.
Paris and London. They deal with all kinds of stuff. And in fact, the protagonist really has a hard time staying out of bed with women.
He did his best.
He did. He made America proud. He certainly did. So this book came about, and Richard and I are both fascinated with World War I. So can you give us a little background on the story of how it came to be and where it came from?
Well, the protagonist is a American college professor who's at loose ends, and he agrees to be an assistant to Colonel House, who is a real life person.
Mm-hmm.
He was the major assistant to President Woodrow Wilson, and his job was to try and gain a peace in the World War before so the United States wouldn't have to get into it. And to do this, he entered into some deals that he probably shouldn't have. Anyhow, what interests me about the war was it was really the first industrial war.
Mm-hmm.
Previous wars didn't have things like tanks, airplanes, poison gas. It was a very different conflict. It actually wasn't the first world war because Britain, England, and France had a world war a century or so before it. But it's the number of people killed gave it that stature of a world war.
Mm-hmm.
And my major focus was to show how this American started off idealistic, and what he saw made him pessimistic about war, about America, about European statesmen, and what the prospects for peace were in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, the basic theme.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of it is how it evolved. The romantic part of it, he had an affair with a woman from the French army, which made both sides very unhappy because they were afraid of what would be given during pillow talk.
Sure.
So that, you know, gave the novel another
nice way of putting
dimension.
It. That was a great movie to me.
No. I mean, there were all sorts of strange things that happened. Can I use the word condoms on the air?
Of course.
Sure.
Well, one of the things that I learned when they captured German soldiers, they found condoms on them. The French soldiers were issued condoms. Guess who wasn't?
The Americans.
Soldiers.
Yeah, sure.
Because it was still the Puritan effect.
No, there it is. Sure. I like it. The story, a lot of it takes place before Italy kind of switched over to the Allies. So we're looking at the Axis powers of the, let me see if I get this right, because I always, Austro-Hungary,
mm-hmm.
Italy, and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then
against France, England, and Russia.
Right. And then France, England, and Russia, and eventually America, and Italy turned over.
Turkey was also on the Germans.
Right. Turkey was also. Yeah.
Which is apparently something we Italians did during World Wars. We'd start on one side and go, now we don't like these guys, let's go over here.
Well, that's sure it happened in World
that
War II.
That was one of
well.
The special deals that the American noticed and
yeah.
said,
yeah.
what's going on?
You know, yeah.
There's, you know, everyone has a special deal, and everyone wants to get something out of the war.
Sure.
And that's what made the Versailles Treaty, you know, mean nothing.
Right. Well, it was really great for everybody but Germany.
yeah. yeah.
The one thing I've always find fascinating about how World War I came about is that Germany actually got into this thinking they could jump over there, run over France real quick, and then turn and face Russia. And that didn't happen. And once that didn't happen, I don't think they could ever figure out a way to get out of the mess they started. And that's what extended it for so long, is everybody got into this, and nobody would look for the exit.
They miscalculated, and no one anticipated trench warfare.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, nobody figured that they were going to dig in.
And that's what made the war last so long.
Yeah.
The generals who fought this war fought it like it was a previous war.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a French general, Joffre, who said the major difference between the two forces is the elan and the daring of the soldiers as they run across the field with their bayonets. And, of course, every bayonet charge, they were mowed down by machine guns.
Sure.
So it was just sheer carnage. But this went on for several years, and the generals didn't learn,
right.
Which is one of the reasons he became, disillusioned.
Right.
Well, World War One really changed the way war was conducted anyway. As you mentioned earlier, because we have tanks, you got the poison gas, you got the machine gunnery.
Airplanes.
The airplanes coming in. It really, because it used to, you'd have the big war where everybody go out in the morning, start shooting. As soon as the sun started going down, okay, let's go and sit down for a while. Now you've got all the rules changed, and you've got generals, like you mentioned, on both sides who didn't understand what worked 20 years ago. Not going to work now.
Right.
And again, that I think that just kind of led to why...
And yet they had new means of destruction.
Right.
So, they're fighting wars in the same way as before, but destroying manpower.
Yeah. Right. And we left out submarines. Submarines came in
true.
World War I, too.
That is true.
Also, another submarines, I should have mentioned before, is another... didn't exist previously.
Right.
And that's what really led the U.S. into the war, was when Germany decided... they had nothing to lose. They had to, go all out and sink Allied shipping because they were starving to death by the English blockade.
Right.
And so they fired on all ships of any flag, merchant or not merchant. And finally, Woodrow Wilson, who was afraid of losing an election, actually, say we have to go to war.
No, a politician making a choice based on getting reelected. Nah, happens. No. Surely you jest, sir.
Now, I'd always been taught, and I suppose, and I probably am like 180 degrees off center bubble here. Wasn't the sinking of the Lusitania one thing that forced Wilson into the war?
It was the beginning of the dramatic moment.
Right.
But there were other ships, too.
Right. Because the Lusitania at that point was not a troop ship.
It wasn't a troop ship, but it carried armaments.
Oh, okay.
And the Germans.
Yeah. Armaments.
And the Germans did.
Yeah. Okay.
In fact, the Germans had warned people not to sail on the ship.
Well, yeah.
And they did anyhow.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah. You know, it always amazed me because the First World War also was the first time that artillery could be sitting back 5 miles. And lob shells in.
They could Germans could shoot a shell into Paris 70 miles away.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that was something.
That's astounding.
They had those big, huge railroad cannons.
Big Bertha.
Yeah. And they had them in World War II, but they didn't use them too much.
The thing that was remarkable is that they had horses pull them.
Yeah. Yeah, we were back in the, we're not learning that this doesn't work anymore stage with that. You know?
Well, the thing is, just like the Apaches, when the horses die, they become food.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Generals still believed in cavalry and a bayonet charge.
Sure, there was still cavalry back then. So,
which carried over to World War II because it took them forever to understand it's not the shooting on the ground. You're going to have to win this thing in the air first.
Right.
And again, it was another example of not learning from the past.
Right.
Mm. But one of the big things was with the in the novel was the American learning about the secret treaties that made Italy change sides, and which gave England and France colonies in the Middle East. And they created these very odd boundaries, ignoring tribes, rivers, mountains, just whatever pleased them.
Right.
Which is still causing trouble today.
Well, now, Russia eventually pulled out, did they not? Because they had to fight their own war. They had their revolution.
The 1917 revolution.
Right.
Russia lost a tremendous amount of men.
Yeah, both sides, because they were fighting each other, plus they were fighting in the war.
Well, they had soldiers fighting. They didn't have ammunition.
Well,
that's $600 clubs.
You can't win that way.
No, it's like remember what I told you earlier in the green room. What do you call a $600 rifle? Misfires. Club.
That's a club.
So
when you started working, you mentioned Colonel House, who was not really a colonel. That was an honorary title given to him from
he
people
was
in Texas.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were working in him. You were working in trying to remember everybody just off the top of my head. You had Woodrow Wilson, obviously. You have a scene in, I believe, what is now Moscow, but it was called Petrograd.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
It was St. Petersburg. Actually.
St. Petersburg. Okay.
Yeah.
Trying to remember my Russian names. It's terrible. But you have a scene where Kirk Johnson is talking with Felix Yusupov, I think is how he pronounced it.
Yeah. Prince Yusupov. Yeah.
So you're working in all these real people from history into a fictional story.
Yeah.
What was the challenge for you to make it to where people would buy the, yeah, okay, I could see that person doing this or saying that?
To make what happened subsequently realistic in their conversation. In other words, I'm sorry, my thought. The Yusupov was against the, I forget the name of the strange man from Siberia.
Rasputin.
And he indicated as much in the conversation. So when Rasputin dies later, you know, it was set up. I wanted to show that the Russian court, which spoke French more than Russian, was not prepared for war. They had a very ill-conceived idea of what war was, and they weren't prepared for it. That was what I wanted to show.
Uh-huh. Well, going back to my history, French at that time was the international diplomatic language, was it not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you probably might. We're going to get you some water, Jack, so you can kind of.
Oh. Yeah, I'm
well,
sorry.
We're sending Richard on an errand of mercy. But the war itself, now you know, Kirk Johnson, I mean, Richard had the same idea that I did, is that we find it kind of hard to like the guy.
Why?
I don't know. It's just that probably because there wasn't a whole lot of me in him.
Well, you know. I tried to set him up, what made him available.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the deal with characters, and we were talking about this in the ride out, was that the deal with protagonists is you're not always going to like every protagonist of a book. I mean, he's going to drive your story, which is what he's there for, but you're not always going to like him.
I didn't want to make him goody good or
yeah. Well, you didn't.
I just want to show a basic shift.
Right.
He starts off, right. Well, we're going to strive for peace,
right.
in a responsible fashion, and he watches how it suddenly shifts or evolves into every country going after its own interests,
right.
and not giving a damn about peace.
Well, you can see is the shift beginning in his journal entries. As he's talking in his journal, and you can see the subtle shifts taking place.
The journal was a literary device to show his progression.
Right. Now, is Kirk Johnson, is he a composite of people?
No,
or
I made
is
him
he,
up.
He's
I
totally made, a fictional made character. Him up. Gotcha.
But I made him up. I made him a college professor.
Yes.
Based on professors I've known.
Okay.
So as a person, no, but
okay.
as his profession, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I noticed that he wasn't, in most stories that are set up this way, the main character is driving the events and making major impacts on the events. And with yours, he was kind of here at key points in different places during this period that the war was conducted, and you could see him changing.
Yeah.
So it was the events were changing him, not so much him driving the events.
It was right. just reverse.
Right.
The events were changing him. You know.
Yeah.
Which I think that happens to a lot of people.
Right.
Well, his job was, that, you know, he didn't have a job that allowed him to change events. All he could do was give information. At one point, remember, he's creates a rundown of armaments and different things.
Mm-hmm.
In that, I tried to slip in his opinions on what he thought about the generals, about warfare, the use of poison in submarines, so forth. But I want to show a gradation as he moved forward,
right.
How he felt about events.
Now, is this book available now?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
It's on Amazon. Okay. And, you know.
And it's been out for how long?
Came out last year.
Last year,
about
okay.
a year.
Because it's an interesting study. We read so many stories in here, and the ones that you really grab you, they grab you, and the ones that you know are good stories are good stories. It's not that often where we get one that grabs you and that's also a good story.
Well, World War One was you know, the epical war
right.
that other wars, you know, since are right. compared to.
It's the war to end
yeah,
all
it
wars.
Was the first industrial war.
Right,
yeah.
sure.
Now, you had him traveling from, as you said, most of it's London and Paris, and but you also have him going to St. Petersburg.
He went to Berlin and Petrograd.
Right.
So,
it
was, you know, how hard was it, I mean, before America got into the war, obviously, was it easier for American diplomats to make those kind of journeys?
No, it wasn't easy. I had to go to the Swiss border, and then the Germans picked him up and took him there. And when he went to Petrograd, he took a British ship to Murmansk up in northern Russia and then took the train from Murmansk to Petrograd.
So it
wasn't easy at all.
So what we saw in the book as far as how he was received at those two different cities as well, that was pretty typical of the time. That's how they were received.
That's
as far as
you know, what I got from the research I did.
Right. Okay.
And I did a lot of research.
I was going to ask you if you checked into what,
well,
actually...
I was a history major at college. I love history.
Me too.
And
yeah.
So it just came natural, you know, to read books to get steeped in the law of the period.
Did you read anything that was written by some of the diplomats who were involved back then? I guess that's what...
I read the biography of House.
Okay.
And I read books about Woodrow Wilson, which showed the split between them, which happened at the end of the book.
Right.
Where Wilson really disowned House. He wanted to make the Versailles Treaty, the big idealistic treaty, and House had run through Europe for the last 3 or 4 years doing just the opposite.
Right.
So it became impossible.
I like how you worked in what happened to Wilson toward the end of his presidency, yeah. too, where we weren't sure who was actually running the government there for a while.
That was his wife.
Yeah.
His wife is running.
Well, he was not a very nice man.
No, he wasn't. He was really. It was in his administration that they showed the birth of the nation.
Right.
He's the only president I think that was really pro
Ku Klux Klan, yeah.
other than Andrew Johnson, you know, who was almost impeached. He was not a, no, I agree with you. He was not a nice guy.
Yeah, he was not a nice guy. He was actually, I think, well, I'm sure we've had racist presidents since then and before, but he was the most outspoken one. He just wasn't just...
Mm. Well, he always thought he was right.
Well, sure.
It reminds me of someone now.
Yeah. Oh, really? Which brings something up. You wrote a book called Montreal Tapes, The Montreal Tapes.
Montreal Tapes, yes.
Yes. And it's about turning the country into an anarchist state, somewhat.
Yeah.
Like now.
Authoritarian.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like it's a mirrored image of what's happening now.
Yeah, that was several years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we all, everybody in this room is just a real fan of our current
That's
president.
That's exciting. Glad to hear it.
Yeah, no, we're not. We're on the air.
Well, you know, the theme of being disillusioned by war is not limited to World War I.
No.
It exists in every war.
I was disillusioned after I came home from Vietnam.
Yeah. And the war in Afghanistan,
sure.
which is going on for... second decade. I can only imagine how many disillusioned soldiers there are.
Was it 13 years, 14 years? It's been going on now? It's the longest war you ever fought.
It's got to be at least 14 or 15.
Yeah, I think we went over in 2003.
And there's no end.
Yeah.
In sight, yeah. And now they want to send more people.
Despite history showing that England didn't succeed in Afghanistan. Russia didn't succeed in Afghanistan.
Yeah, you know, Russia, Afghanistan was in the 80s. That wasn't that far back that we could have possibly forgotten how well that went for the Russians.
Well,
while they were there.
They
we know how well it
retreat.
Went because we supplied the Mujahideen.
They were smart enough to retreat.
Yeah.
Right, right. We're in the studio with Jack Adler, and time is now 28 minutes after the hour. And we have a real quick thing here, and then we're going to get right back to Jack. And this is for Mr. Russ Avison, and I think I may have it, and if not, we're just going to... There we go. All right. You're leaving on vacation. Tickets have been purchased. Hotel reservations are confirmed. Mail delivery has been suspended. What about the dog?
Uh-oh.
All Dogs Rule, day camp and sleepovers. It's the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside amongst orange trees, grass, and a country setting. Well, I don't know if nothing burned over there, so I think we're okay. Your dog gets to be, well, your dog gets to be, well, a dog.
Yes.
Yeah. All Dogs Rule offers additional services, including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming sessions in the creek, and training. Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call, 805-524-1100. When your pup returns home with that smile on his face, will you leave wondering whose vacation was better? The dog's. The dogs. Okay.
I dropped mine off this weekend, but then they expect you to come and get them back, you know.
Yeah, I know. You can't. They didn't want to keep them forever. Nah. So anyway, Russ, I'm glad you're home. You tell me today that you've been home since Sunday. That's a good thing. No flames, no smoke, no nothing.
Excellent news.
Of course, you'll be on with me next week. Russ is our, he's my once-a-month co-host on the fourth Thursday of the month. And I just love Russ. He's a great
It's a rotating
guy.
Chair over here. Wow.
It truly is.
Bobby Jean left her M&Ms with peanuts over here.
I get the best co-host, though. I swear, I do. Once again, if you want to call in and talk to Jack Adler, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. Let's switch gears here a little bit. How long did it take you to write this book?
It's very hard to gauge because the writing is uneven. It isn't as if you sit and write 2 hours a day and then 4 hours the next day.
Sure.
So, you know, it took several months easily. Easily several
months. Was that actual writing, or does that include the research
that
you were doing? No,
that's the writing. The research takes much longer.
You're right, exactly.
You know. And I read fast. I can skim read. But still, you know, these history books are big. And I read it all.
Now, do you prefer, when you do your research, do you prefer going to the library and digging into the volumes, or do you research off the Internet? Because a lot of people do that as well.
Well, I research wherever I can find it.
Uh-huh.
Internet is just one outlet,
right?
But not the major one. The major one are books, which I take out of the library. I don't go sit at the library and read. I get books at home, and I read it when I can.
Sure.
I'm freelance, so I have plenty of time. You know.
Now, when I researched from the fields, I actually had to go to the basement of a museum, put on white gloves, and take out a box one at a time and go through 8 boxes of film.
Oh, yeah.
One frame at a time. So, yeah, that can take some time when you have to do it that way.
At college, I had to do that for a historiography class. Go to the library and put on and look at the microfilm.
Microfilm, yeah.
Yeah.
They had the old microfiche readers. And God, I hated those things. Now you just punch it up on a Google and you get it. Mm. Bingo. Done. When you write, do you write from an outline? Do you write freehand?
I generally try to have a tentative outline, which is subjected to major changes at any moment.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
I try to have an idea of, you know, what the theme is and what the major events will be.
Right.
But otherwise, you know, a book is sometimes character driven, so
we're working, as we told you, we're working on a novel together, and we got a 7-8 page paragraph synopsis of the story, but it's deviated so much now because you're right. The characters will say, as you're writing them, they go, wait a minute, I'm not going to do that. That's not something I would do. I would do this. Right.
If you have, you know, real good characters, they're going to tell you where to go.
Right, right. And it's just, it amazes. I'm surprised sometimes where they are and what
they're
doing.
That's good. It's a good surprise.
Yeah, and it truly is. You've been writing for how many years? I'm not going to get
a
there.
A long time.
Okay, but what I'm getting at is your fiction and your nonfiction books. Mm-hmm. How long have you been?
Well, there isn't any formula. It depends what, you know, grabs me at the time. But I've written several nonfiction books,
uh-huh.
yeah, which, uh, and, uh, which require a lot more research.
Right. Yeah. And you said you collaborated with one guy on one nonfiction book.
I collaborated with another guy on a book about travel security.
Mm-hmm.
He was someone with the RAND Corporation and was an authority on security. And I interviewed him for my column for the L.A. Times, which is how we met, and we agreed to write a book together, which was chosen by the Library of Congress for translation into Braille.
Didn't really?
It didn't mean more royalties. It was just an honor.
Hey, that's an honor. You take them where you get them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Grab them while you can.
But you've been a newspaper writer since way back in the before time. We'll just go that way.
When they were still typesetting.
I started in Gutenberg. The mid-80s, but at what point did you decide you may be
in
still
high school?
No, I mean, but when did you decide you wanted to transition from doing newspapers and focus more on books?
Well, it wasn't that I decided to do it. It was kind of forced upon me.
Ah, welcome to the club. Yeah.
It's not as if I suddenly decided, well, I'm going to quit my job. It didn't work that way.
Yeah.
My job didn't exist.
Same here.
So, I began writing, and I had enough good things happening that I could keep doing it.
Yeah.
And a wife who understood.
There you go. That's the key right there. Yeah.
That's a biggie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm same boat. So I was just curious if you had just decided you were done going out and doing that, or if it was just...
No, I didn't say, suddenly I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock every morning and write.
Wrote you a memo and said you're going to do it this way now, huh?
And okay. Then, you know, yeah.
Really? You don't do that?
No, I've never gotten up before, unless it was to do KP in the Army.
There you go.
Oh, God. I have that T-shirt.
Yeah, the rule at my house is you ring my doorbell before 6 a.m., my house had better be on fire. Otherwise, we got problems.
I send you texts at like 5, but you don't ever answer them.
I have a time machine.
Yeah, you don't answer them even when you're awake.
That's true.
So you've written several books. I mean, I'm looking at a list here, and I'm amazed at the diversity. City Havoc, Montreal Tapes, DiMario's Revenge. I know I've done that's about an Italian gang, right? Mm-hmm. Bitter Shields, American Exceptionalism. I'm really interested in American Exceptionalism.
Yeah, I think the book was mistitled because I think I didn't realize it until afterwards that people thought it was a scholarly book,
uh-huh.
And it's not. It's a novel.
It's a novel?
And it takes a very pointed view that American exceptionalism doesn't mean what it used to mean.
Uh-huh.
That it's just an expression that's bandied about, and it gives us a false sense of we're special people.
Mm-hmm.
And we do the same silly things that other people do.
Sure.
We're no different. And this, again, is a college professor.
Okay.
So you can see, how I gravitate to a certain type of character who writes a book pointing this out, and he gets his PhD, and he's looking for a job. And his job turns out to be at a Tennessee university, which I made up. And, of course, he's among people who are of a different political temperament, which leads to a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the book, he gets kidnapped by a right-wing fanatic and who asks him to recant everything. And that's the story. But the point of the book is that American exceptionalism is just a very weak, outmoded expression. Not everyone agrees with that, of course. So I hope it would be more controversial than it is, but no one gives a damn.
Now, that's not actually out yet, is it?
No, that's been published.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't you have something in the wings that's due next month?
I have a historical novel coming out. Probably sometime late next year.
Oh, okay.
About an actual incident that happened in 1902 in New York, where the Roosevelt administration wanted to make sure they won an election, a local election, and they wanted the Jewish vote. And so they sent a reporter, not a college professor, to Romania, where there had been a pogrom. And the story is about a pogrom, mm-hmm. and how they arise and what happens. And he gets captured, and he has lots of adventures. But that's not out the next year.
Oh, okay.
It's called The Tides of Faith.
The Tides of Faith. Do you title your books before you write them, or
do you get halfway
into the book and then you go, okay, this is a good title?
Well, it can happen anytime. You know, your mind works all the time.
It's hard to shut mine off.
And you know, whenever a nice expression comes to mind, you jot it down, and it's a possibility.
Yeah.
But generally, the title comes toward the end, because then you have more of it to look at. Yeah. You know. And your title can change too. You thought of
title. Yeah, we have a working title and then a final title. Yeah,
yeah.
Because I did that book I was telling you about, Contraband Cowboys, about the black cowboys in the West.
Contraband Cowboys, yeah. Very good title.
It's a great title. It's a great book, but
very good title.
But it came because I did a description and historical reference to contraband, which was the word used for the blacks before and after the Civil War, and then the cowboys part came. Because these two brothers, of course, they were cowboys, so it Contraband Cowboys. That just fit.
That's a very, very good title.
But it's just it seems that that you're right. It can come at any time, and it's just like wow. You wake up one morning, and you go, "There's the book." Like this one that's going to the university. I've dreamt it. And I dreamt the entire story, and when I woke up, I remembered it.
You remembered it. That's even more remarkable.
You know, and I even remembered the kid's name, so that became the title of the book, which is Jonah Blue.
Oh.
So it's actually a pretty good story. What are you reading now?
I'm reading history about the United States during the 1920s.
Oh.
During Prohibition. Kind of a follow-up to the verse after the verse.
Sure, sure.
On what happens to America, you know, we helped the Allies win the war, and what are we going to do now? Are we going to bask in that, or are we going to do something? And we bask. We didn't do anything to keep the peace.
No, we didn't.
And I have a prospective American hero who is not a college professor. he's just an ordinary low-level person in the State Department who doesn't like what's going on.
So
don't like it. He doesn't like what's going on.
So along that line, you mentioned we didn't really do a very good job of making sure we didn't have World War II pop on us. I've talked to a lot of different historians, and they get different opinions on this. Wilson's health kind of kept him from being a little bit more proactive in the treaty. Did that really actually create a situation where Germany really got kind of shafted on that treaty, or did it really matter? I mean, was England and France going to get their pound of flesh no matter what?
England and France were going to get their pound of flesh one way or the other.
Okay.
Wilson didn't have any control about it, which is why he was so frustrated with Colonel House.
Right.
But Wilson's failure was that he refused to compromise. He didn't invite any Republicans to go with him to Versailles,
right.
And he wasn't willing to compromise with them on the treaty. And he had tremendous opposition from Republicans. He said, you know, he just felt he was right, and he wouldn't budge.
Yeah.
Well, the majority of the war was fought in France, the World War One.
Yeah, I mean
the majority of it.
Battles, you know.
Yeah, the Ardennes and all through there, and France wanted their reparations, and they really bounced Germany badly. And I remember reading about that.
Clemenceau, who was the French premier,
right?
Said, you know, they had to have a South Lorraine, and they had to have reparations,
right?
And there was no two ways about it,
right?
And he had, you know, the famous line that.
Right.
The Lord only has 10 commandments, and Wilson has 14.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they also separated Austro-Hungary from Germany.
Well, no, they didn't separate. Well, yeah, they did, yeah. But it collapsed.
Well, yeah, before. It did. Yeah. And Austria became its own state.
Yeah, very tiny.
You
know? And so was Hungary, you know. And they both very totalitarian,
right.
And anti-Semitic.
Right. You know? Now I'm going to ask you a question that is, it's prevalent in this show. If you've listened to the show, then you know what the question is going to be. The name of the show, of course, is The Writer's Block. Have you ever had writer's block?
No.
Okay.
No.
I hate him.
I know. I, the last two writers we've on, everybody said, no, never had it.
Okay.
Well, I mean, how do you, what criteria do you use for writer's block?
Well, I,
that,
it's,
that
I,
you absolutely cannot put your fingers on a,
I,
on
I don't
a
think there is
or,
one. I don't think there is a definitive definition of the writer's block. It's just everybody has their own idea of what it is and how it affects them. Some have never had it.
Well, to me, a writer's block is not that you can't write, you don't write, is that you don't have an idea that you want to write about.
Or
that is a block.
That's a good definition.
Or where I go from here.
Yeah. What do you, there's nothing that excites me that I want to do.
Right.
So to me, that's a block.
Right. You know. Now, we had Margaret Brownlee, who is a writer. She does Western romance novels.
Mm-hmm.
She's on the New York Times bestseller list, and she's just really deluxe, delicious. Mm-hmm. She lives over by me in Simi Valley, actually. But she, her explanation was, if she gets it, she gets blocked. She just goes back and rewrites the entire chapter.
Well, you know, I think for newspaper writers, which you and I are former, you couldn't afford to get writer's block because your job was to get in there and you
had
to write
a story.
You have to write something or you're going to be replaced by somebody who can.
It was due, every week.
That's true.
I had to turn it in.
You can't afford to get a block.
Yeah.
So the only thing is if I get kind of hung up on something, I can take the day off and I don't get fired, but that's the only difference now. But, I think for newspaper people, because we do it on a daily basis, we don't get it.
Right.
Or we don't get it that badly. Whereas I think somebody who is just starting, didn't do it as a living, you can see, well, now I don't know what I want to do. I don't know what to do next. And they just get themselves all tangled up.
Well, I think, and this is my opinion, is the way I call it writer's pause.
There you go.
And I think the more you write, the longer you've written, the longer you've settled in and learned how to do it, the less you get stopped.
That's a good point, because another thing that's related to that is that writers have to learn to trust their imagination.
Right.
Yeah.
They're really afraid.
Right.
Of what if they do something that is not going to be accurate? It's not going to be true. It'll be laughed at. You know, they have to trust themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is not easy to.
No,
and that's where you get a good editor who corrects those little bumps that you got to smooth down. So
right,
yeah,
I try to tell people. I mean, people ask us, and they ask Richard, they ask me, and we go to signings and stuff, and they, well, do you let your friends read your stuff? No,
I don't let my wife read my stuff.
Well, my wife is my editor, so I have to let her read it. But she busts my butt, so she's good.
My wife was born in Finland, and she learned English.
Oh yeah, you don't want her.
And she looks at something I've written in a different way than I would.
Sure.
And particularly, writing. If you learn to write newspaper style, sometimes you use that in writing fiction. It just blends in.
Yeah.
And newspaper writing is a different type of writing, actually.
Uh-huh. That is true.
You take
it
liberties
that is true.
With it, and she doesn't understand that always.
She is stickler for the Oxford comma, I take it?
Well, she learned English grammar, and that's it.
Yeah, we talk about the
There's
Oxford
no
comma all the time.
There's no deviation.
There you go. Our guest tonight has been Jack Adler, and his book is called A Colleague in the Shadows, and it can be found where?
It can be found on Amazon, and you can order it or get it at any bookstore.
Okay.
And
online, offline?
On Nook, all the, the usual
electronic
outlets.
Of course.
Electronic outlets.
You know. Okay. And what, do you have a website?
Yes. Well, I have a... it's... I use a place called Antares. I don't know if you heard of it, but I'm the travel editor of it, and I use that to publicize.
And email address?
Oh, jadler@prodigy.net.
Okay, good. And again, the book is called College, or A Colleague in the Shadows, or In Shadows, and it's available Amazon and all online and storefront booksellers. Mm-hmm. And along with a multitude of other books. So if you find Jack's book, look for other titles. And we thank you so much for spending an evening with us.
Thank you very much for a very...
It's been a hoot having you in here.
Oh, I enjoyed being here.
And we enjoyed having you.
It was a good conversation.
Oh, yeah. We're trying to make it like a front porch opportunity. You know, just kick back, have a beer, and relax.
Where's the beer?
There is none.
Ronan won't stock the refrigerator anymore.
I know. Well, that's because you drank it all last time you were here.
I can neither confirm nor deny that allegation.
Next week, we have a writer, Eric Anderson, who has written a book called Osiris. Ooh. And I, if I'm not mistaken, and the book he tells me I'm not, is that I think this has been made into a movie. I'm not sure. We'll have to check with him next week. But again, his name is Eric Anderson. He'll be with us via phone. And, of course, Russ will be in that seat over there.
Yep.
And we'll see, get a little first-hand information on the fire. He's got some terrific pictures of the DC-10 dumping the flame retardant and stuff down in the valley. So
that's a little too close for my comfort, I think.
Yeah, for his too.
So I won't be back this year. I'm not coming back
until
next year.
You're not. Bobby Jean will be joining us again after the first of the year, but it'll be a call-in only. And since this is our Christmas show, I would like for all of us, the Writer's Block, Bobby Jean and Richard and Russ and myself, I wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a wonderful New Year. And that, Jack, that goes for
Merry
you.
Merry Christmas and a happy
And we just appreciate everybody that's been listening to this show. We're up over 500,000 now, so that's terrific for a little show that started 2.5 years ago. We love it, and we love you, and thank you so much. And for everybody at the Writer's Block, myself included, this is a Thursday night. We are out of here, and have yourself a wonderful, wonderful Christmas. We will be here next week, same time, same bat channel.